And our speaker this morning is Dr. Barry T. Mitzner. And Dr. Mitzner is a 1975 graduate of the University of Georgia and is the head of professional services for Vet Lab Supply Incorporated and the director for the Research Center for In-House Diagnostics, and a laboratory industry consulting firm. Dr. Mitzner is a frequent speaker on the subject of in-house testing at local, state, and national meetings. And now I'll introduce you to Dr. Mitzner and let him give his talk.
Thank you.
I told them they had to give me a wireless mic because I'm too antsy to stand up behind a podium. Anyway, maybe I'll give you a little bit more about me so you know from whence I came. Veterinarians, technicians in the room, what do we have? Mix? Good. I came out of Georgia in 75, as she said. I practiced for 10 years, 5 years in a practice as an associate, and then another 5 years as a relief veterinarian. I got interested, actually, when I was in practice, in the subject of in-house testing. I felt that we were deficient, although we had probably had in that practice as good as anybody had at the time, but I thought we could do better, and I got interested in improving it and kind of found out there wasn't any real good sources. You know, there were no IDEXs, there were no Abaxuses, there were no HESCAs back then. You know, I won't date myself, but Pittman Moore was the only company that actually had anything specifically for veterinarians, and it was a real bear to operate. So I felt like veterinarians needed something of a source, and I got interested in it, and the next thing I knew, I was involved in bringing that knowledge to the profession, and that's kind of what I've been doing since 1985. So I don't really do any practice. I'm in a lot of practices, but I still take my dog to the vet. So anyway, so that's a little bit about me. I'm a veterinarian who is still looking for a career. See what I want to do when I grow up. So we're going to be talking this morning, obviously, about the in-house lab. That's what I do. That's what I talk about. It's what I've dealt with for 20 years. Been in a lot of hospitals, a lot of emergency clinics, a few schools, institutes, manufacturers. So I get a real good sampling of what's actually available and what's going on out there. I hope this will be a fun presentation for you because, like the way I do things, I don't stay on any one subject for a real long time. I have a short attention span. So, you know, if I'm talking about something you're bored with, don't worry. You know, in 2 minutes you're going to be on to something else. So anyway, I want to go ahead and get started. No, because it's my pointer. Okay, well, I guess I'm going to have to do it the hard way. Oh, there we go. Okay, hopefully it's going to behave as soon as I get it to stop here. Okay, all right. Pray this is going to work here. Okay, all right. So we're going to talk about microscopes first. I sat in on Dr. Dennis DeNicola's little presentation yesterday, and he shares the same baffling state of mind that veterinarians will go out and they will spend thousands on ultrasound, digital radiographs, endoscopes. But when it comes time to buy a microscope, here we go. Hang on. Move that out of the way so we don't go backwards now. Okay. They'll spend thousands on a fancy piece of equipment. Comes time to buy a microscope, they want to go cheap. So, anyway, let me make a few suggestions. First of all, before you buy a microscope, decide what it is you want to do with it. Nowadays, To our credit, veterinarians are doing more cytology, and of course that's a valuable adjunct to practice, and we'll talk a little bit about that later on. Get the best optics that you can afford. I will tell you that the difference between adequate and good isn't very much anymore. That's the good news. Today you get a lot of microscope for your money. So don't be timid about spending money on it. And if you take care of the microscope, and a good microscope taken care of should last 10 years, even longer than that, you're talking about the difference in adequate and good being pennies a day. So be a little bit brave when you go to spend money. Okay, cleaning and maintenance. I cannot say enough about this. This is a real problem in veterinary clinics. You need to do this regularly. If you don't clean the microscopes, you leave dirt, you leave grit on it, and then somebody one day comes in and says, darn, I can't see through this thing. And what do? They grab a gauze sponge, or if they're good, they'll grab a Kim wipe and they'll start wiping away, and with that little bit of grit that's on there, they'll start sanding down the objectives and scratching them, and then, you know, you get down the road a few years and you wonder why you can't see it anymore or see through it. So, you know, what you want to do when you clean the microscope before you touch it with anything is to get one of these little air cans, which you should also have to clean your computers and your lab equipment with, and shoot it on those lenses first to blow off any solid material, and then you can go ahead and do your cleaning. Okay, always keep an extra bulb. I generally tell people, the mouse has a mind of its own there. I generally tell people to keep one in the drawer where people can find it and hide one that somebody knows where it is, because invariably the bulbs burn out on a Saturday or a Saturday afternoon, you know, and then you're down and out. A lot of people, and I also recommend it, people say, I want to get a good microscope because, you know, they're going to run fecals and all kinds of stuff on it. They're going to mess it up anyway. So that's where you can go a little less expensively. If you want to get a scope just for doing fecals, it's probably a good idea. Okay. All right. Upgrading. If you think you're going to do any telemedicine, take any pictures, do anything like that, maybe put video on it to show clients, I recommend that you go ahead and do it on the front end. You're going to be better off. You can get cameras that will shoot through the eyepiece for you, but you will be better off if you go ahead and buy this little trinocular head, or just the head and the adapter. You can always add the camera later. If you get down the road with your microscope and then you decide to buy the trinocular head later, then you're going to take off the old head, put it in a drawer, and you're going to spend some big money. So the difference sometimes in upgrading, you know, could be as little as $300 versus doing it later, and it could cost you $700, $800,000. So if maybe you're not ready to do it yet, you know, but if you think you want to, I tell you to go ahead and do it at the front end. Okay, things you want to consider when you're buying your microscope. I just talked to you about the trinocular head. That's that center thing that's up top. Let's see if I can make my pointer work. I'm really afraid to do anything with this thing for fear that it's going to go on the fritz on me again. Okay, you hear, if you all go to cytology courses, you hear a lot about 50 and 60x high-dry objectives. The advantage to that, it's obviously a little more magnification than your 40, and by having that, you may not have to use the oil, which, of course, is going to give you the best magnification, but you have to move around a lot on the slide to see everything. The plan is your flat field optics. That means that the entire microscope field will be in focus. You'll find, go back and look at your microscope if you have one of the less expensive ones, and you look carefully, the field at the edge is going to be kind of fuzzy. And that's your basic achromatic objectives. And now I will tell you, even on the less expensive microscopes, those optics are getting better and better, and a lot of them are coming stock with semi-plan objectives. Yes? Well, some of the companies, and not everybody will do this, because most companies, they sell you a microscope, it's got 4, 10, 40, and 100 on it. But if you ask some of the companies, they may, and you say, you know what, I don't want 4X, but can you sell me, can you upgrade one of mine to a 50 or a 60, or maybe just upgrade your 40 to it, some of them will do that, you know, and you'll take one off, and you'll put that on. If it's the 4X, you're going to get a relatively minuscule credit. The 50 and 60X objectives are pretty expensive little things, but a lot of people who go to the cytology courses that, like here, that they give, come out of there saying, that's what I want to have. Did that answer your question? Yeah. The phase contrast, you know, if you're doing semen work or some other things, might be nice to have. You don't have to have all of these, but there are upgrades besides that trinocular head that you might want to consider. Okay, let me talk about that 60X objective. I've tried to represent here what a typical field would look like in a blood smear with a 40X objective on it. Now, if you do spend some time with the microscope, you should be able to identify that we've got a neutrophil lymphocyte in there. That's not so bad. Okay, but if we look at it through a 60X objective, not bad, huh? That's why people like these. So you get a lot more cellular detail if you do that, okay? And you don't have to go to the oil and fiddle around and get the microscope all dirty. So it's something, it's an upgrade that certainly is worthwhile if you enjoy doing microscopy. And even if you don't enjoy doing microscopy, maybe if you get this, you will enjoy doing microscopy. So let me talk about cameras. Since I kind of mentioned them in passing offhand, there's a number of different kinds of cameras. Analog is your basic television camera. Okay, most of the analog cameras will just plug right into an eyepiece, or they will plug in a trinocular head. Most of the time with an analog camera, people are using them maybe in the exam rooms to show clients what a stool specimen with parasite eggs, ear mites, and that sort of thing. Not so much the cytology. Now, something I've learned recently, I'm always learning things. Every time I go to do a conference and I start thumbing through things, I find some new stuff. So I'll share that with you because some of what I'm going to talk about today isn't in your notes. What I found recently is on these analog cameras, these inexpensive ones, I say inexpensive, you know, in the under 300 category, they work fine at the lower powers, but when you get up into 40 and especially when you get up into oil, you can't push enough light through them to get any real color out of them. So that's kind of disappointing. There are better analog cameras that you can buy that will certainly handle it. Those are most of the ones that I dealt with, and that's why I never saw this problem before, but I recently ran into it with someone who had an analog camera and decided that they wanted to use it for more than just looking at mites and showing clients. They wanted to do more with it, and we found we couldn't get color out of it. USB cameras are extremely popular. This way your image can be sent right to your computer or right to your computer monitor. You can still use them for demonstrating to clients. But what's nice about those is you can actually save the images. So when you're doing some cytology and you say, oh, that's a really cool picture, I want to save it for training, or if you have that capability, you want to put it into a client's record, you can do it. These cameras will save images in your standard JPEG. Actually, you can select for most of them. It depends a little on the software. There are also cameras out there that are combination USB and analog. So you can actually, with something like that, you can actually have the camera set up. You can have part of it going to the computer screen if you want to save the image, and then you've got another shot going over to a regular TV monitor if you want to be showing clients. And most of them can be used either in eyepiece or Trinoc mounted, but I still would recommend the Trinoc. It's a whole lot more convenient than taking the eyepiece camera in and out. The Trinocs, almost all of them are going to need some kind of an adapter. Some of the cameras will come with it, some won't. So you have to figure that in. You have to ask the question. You know, you go out and buy the camera, you get it back to the clinic, you open the box, and you say, well, how does this thing go in there? Like I said, some of them will come with an adapter, some of them will go right into the eye tube, you know, but others you may have to get some type of a coupler. So do keep that in mind. Couplers can be anywhere from $100 to as much as $300, depending on the camera. Okay, and here's a couple of shots of two cameras, and these are both relatively inexpensive, under $300. The little USB camera does a pretty nice job, and one of the problems that we had for a long time with the computer cameras is we didn't get real time. Now, what does real time mean? Real time is when you're scanning around the slide and there's a little lag in there while the picture refocuses. But due to better computers and better response cameras, even the less expensive USB cameras can actually function in real time, which is good. It makes it kind of applicable if you want to show clients things. So you probably figured out I lean towards the USB cameras because I think you can do more with them. Now, here's some stuff I learned recently, trial by fire stuff. If you're going to use a USB camera, most of them will work on any computer, even something fairly old, but if you want that real-time projection, okay, you must have USB 2.0, which is the format that came after the original USB 1. Most any computer purchased, I would say, within the last 3 years is going to have the USB 2.0. What that allows it to do is transfer the data from the camera faster to the computer, and that's how you get your real time. We also recommend that you have a video card in there, and most computers will kind of come along with a built-in video card, and you know your computer guru can tell you how to go into the settings and figure out how much RAM you've got on the video card. But to get good images, I do recommend that you, if you don't have 64 megabytes of memory on that video card that's in your computer, you go out and get one, and you're not talking about a big expense. They're about $30, you know, to buy one. And most people should be able to just install them themselves. They can figure out how to get the screws out of the case. They can install them. Also, I would suggest use an LCD monitor. If you're going to go to the trouble of having a camera and showing images, you want a nice picture. Fortunately, LCD monitors are down to $100 now and falling. In fact, I don't think there's any reason for anybody to use a CRT monitor. That's the big one, you know, the big fat one that sits on your desk anymore. If for no other reason than looking at a CRT. Anybody using CRT still? The big monitors? Y'all using LCDs? Good. Good. What's that? You still have got a few of them. If you spend a lot of time in front of them like I do, you don't realize how tired they make your eyes because they have a constant refresh rate. Even though it's fast, your eye begins to detect it. So you need to go spend your $100, you know, and upgrade all those. But for your images, it's really the way to go. And most of these will come with some type of image capture software. It may be very basic. In a lot of cases, it's all you need. But you can run these cameras. You can capture images into Adobe Photoshop if you're a Saturday computer geek like I am. You can do all kinds of things with it because they're just like taking pictures with your little Flick digital camera. Okay, I have to show this. This is my disclaimer that I put up here because I'm showing you all a lot of products today. Okay, but I want you to understand that what I'm showing you is not necessarily a personal endorsement. They're products that I've looked at that I think may have some usefulness, but I think it's important for you to look at them critically yourself. I'm going to give you a few facts about what to look for, but it's critical that you look at it yourself and, you know, kind of make your own decisions on this. The other thing that's not on the disclaimer that I want to make very clear today, I am not a clinical pathologist. You know, I'm a veterinarian, just like some of you folks that are here. I just happen to have spent the last 20 years looking at in-house lab testing, so by osmosis, I've absorbed some things somewhere along the way. But I'm going to really try not to do any interpretation for you, because I that is not my qualification. Sometimes I can help. So anyway, I just want you all to know that, where we're standing. Okay, the first thing I want to talk about is sampling. You know, bad samples give bad lab results. I don't care how much money you spend on your lab equipment, it cannot take a lousy sample and give you a good result. It's just not going to happen. Okay, and this is the number two problem, okay, in laboratory testing in the office behind what? Number one. What's the number one problem in laboratory testing? People. Not following the procedure. Pilot error. Number one, by a long shot. Number two is sample issues that somebody doesn't recognize. Okay. These are my tips on drawing samples. How many people draw samples with a syringe and transfer to a vacutainer? About 3/4 of you, maybe a little bit more. Okay. Particularly when it comes to hematology, you know, that's problematic. We have enough of a problem with platelet aggregation in dogs and cats without adding another factor to it. So I would encourage everybody to try to use the vacutainers in the manner in which they were intended, you know, just like what they do with you folks. That way the blood is being drawn directly into the EDTA, and you got a whole lot better chance of not having the platelet aggregation, or at least having it minimal. And, you know, if you went to any of the hematology lectures, they all talk about this, and the guys with the lasers say it's a problem with the impedance counters, but then you talk to the laser people, and they say, well, they can't really take them apart, you know, but, and I sit back there and I say, well, you just draw good samples. I'm not saying it's not going to happen, but if you just draw good samples, this is just not going to be as big an issue as you make it out to be. Jugular veins whenever possible, because that way you're not, you know, kind of sitting there on these small animals sort of dribbling it into the syringe. You're much more likely to get clots then. In the process of doing that, you may be holding the vein off, which is going to elevate your packed cell volume and maybe some other parameters. So you want to avoid doing that. You want to avoid doing that stuff, you know, with the syringe. And then, of course, probing around looking for the vein is going to pull up some tissue fluids that are in there, and these are going to cause, or this is going to cause, platelets to aggregate. Here's a bunch of different things for hematology collection, because this is the place where hematology is the place where you're going to create problems that are not going to be visually evident to you. I've got the good old syringe in there. I've got some microcollection tubes. I've got a bottle of actual liquid EDTA that, if you really don't want to let go of your syringe and you want to put a drop of EDTA into the syringe, it's kind of an extra step, you can do that, but what? You know, once you do that, you do not want to go and put it into another EDTA tube, because you have too much EDTA in there, so you got to kind of program yourself not to do that. In that picture is something called, well, you have a vacutainer, you know, the way it's supposed to be used. You got some capillary tubes. The first thing I'm going to tell you is be sure you choose the right size tube. Nothing pees me more than when I go into a clinic and I say, you know, when I'm looking at their instrumentation and they say, well, you know, why is this happening? I say, well, go draw me a sample, and they bring me in this 5 mL tube with a 0.5 mL of blood in the bottom of it. You know, first of all, that sample's going to be diluted. Second of all, the EDTA does have some hypertonicity to it, and it's going to alter the cells. So with anything that you use, you want to strive to fill that tube at least half full. You know, and if you're dealing with a little animal and you don't think you can get that much blood, you need to be using one of these microcollection devices. Okay? So pay attention to what you're doing. The other product that's in there, it's that third little thing over there by the vacutainer. I don't know if anybody's ever used this. But all you 75% of you folks out there that are still using syringes, you might consider doing this. because it will bail you out. It will give you better samples. Now, I usually bring a sample of it. I've got one I'm going to show you a little bit later. Same kind of product that we use for your analysis, but I'll just give you, since we got a smallish group, I'll just give you a quick overview. This one's for urine, but it works exactly the same way. As you can see, it's a combination tube and syringe. Very nice. You know, you can do your thing with it. Has the EDTA in it. You can get them as small as 1.2 mils. Actually, I may have a picture of it here. Let me see. Okay. Oh, let me say something about tubes, and I'll come back to it. All right. Vacutainers. Pretty soon, all you're going to see is plastic. Okay. Vacuum tube industry is human side driven. People don't want broken glass. People don't want to be exposed to all those nasty germs. So they all want plastic now, and that's what you're going to see. The other thing that's happening is those little, 2 mil tubes that we've used for years for the little animals, they're going away. Okay, what they're doing now is through their fancy computer manufacturing, they're making the tubes with the, they're able to calibrate the vacuum. So a tube that, if you look at it, is a 5 mil tube, it's still only going to draw 2 mils before it stops. Now, you people who are turning around and pressing the needle through the top and pushing blood into there, okay, you're probably going to be able to put more than 2 mils in there. Okay, but if you don't pay attention to the draw for these, what's going to happen, particularly on the hematology, you're going to put more blood than you have EDTA and the sample's going to clot. You're going to wonder why. Okay, so on these tubes, as you're getting them, take a look at them and see exactly what the recommended draw is, and don't put any more in there than is there. Okay, does anybody use this method, this very scientific dribble method? Well, I was taught this at the University of Georgia. I plead guilty on this because I was taught this is the way to do it because it won't hemolyze the samples, or I don't know. There was a whole bunch of reasons they told us. So I did a little straw poll amongst some people in universities and reference labs and clinics and so forth. Some that were real big on doing this, and some that said why. And what we found is that there really wasn't any proven advantage to doing this. What's even more dangerous about this is as the little tubes go away, okay, what's going to happen is we're going to start getting overfilled tubes because you pulled the plug off of it. I just got through telling you to put enough blood in the tube, and you're going to make sure that you do that. Okay, so anyway, if you're using that, I don't know. You know, my experience is it doesn't make any difference. No. And then again, you're having to recap your syringes. It's just not a good way to do things, in my opinion. It really doesn't bring any. Okay, here's your Monovet again. Okay, all in one syringe and tube combination. You are going to be able to get these, at least I hope, for a while in a 1.2 mil, which is a nice small size for small animals. And because you're not transferring the sample from a syringe to a tube, okay, because it does become a tube after you draw it, you're going to get a better quality sample, I can almost guarantee you, because what you're doing is you're drawing the sample, and again, this is just a larger one, you're drawing the sample, okay, and then when you get it in the tube, you take that little end off of it, voila, you have yourself a little vacutainer, okay, with a screw cap. So you can take it right to your hematology unit. You have to pull off the rubber cap and go, get blood on your shirt. Okay? So it's a very, very convenient product to use. And you will, if you do it, you will get better samples. Okay, and here's the drawing procedure. You can kind of see how it works. That's a people arm. They use this quite a bit in Europe. It hasn't really caught on that much in the U.S., I think that people on the human side are obviously very ingrained in the vacutainer system, and why not? It works very well. But, we got 75% of our people over here that are drawing with syringes and wondering why their samples aren't good. Maybe we should consider doing this. So anyway, here's something that will improve your sample quality. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about chemistry. Okay, does everybody recognize what we have here? What's the first one on the going from the left to the right? What do we got? Lipemia. What do we got in the middle? Hemolysis. What do we got on the end? Icterus. Okay. You would be surprised how many people, and it's not you folks because you're sitting in here, but you would be surprised how many hospitals I go into where people are running samples that look like this and wondering why their results don't come out. You would be surprised. You know, and I've encouraged, you know, whoever's direct, I said, make sure people know this, you know. They should look at that and they say, you know, there's no sense in wasting all that expensive reagent on it. You need to do something about this. Okay, so what can you do about it? Let's go here. Click, click. We'll do it from there. Okay, here's how we're going to handle the lipemic samples. This is Prodigal LipoClear. I'm sure that some of you had experience with it. You would add it to the sample. Okay, it'll take about 10 or 20 minutes, and you centrifuge it, and all the fat goes to the bottom, and then you're left with some nice, clear serum. And it's been used in pretty much every benchtop system that's out there. And everybody should have it in their lab. Okay, because most of the lipemia that you see is related to postprandial. It's not a pathologic lipemia. Now, some of those pathologic lipemias may or may not clear because they're a little different, you know. But this gives you a way around those fatty samples and allows you to run it and get a good result. All right. Icterus. What are you going to do about that one? Not a whole lot. If it's not real icteric, okay, you can go back there and maybe dilute it a little bit. Okay, get it a little clear. It may run. Some chemistry systems are a little more prone to icterus problems than others. Some of the dry slide systems, like the OrthoDT and the VET test, supposedly do a little better job with these. Okay. These may just be a problem. They may just be a problem. What I would suggest to you as far as icteric samples that you can't dilute and rerun, take a look in your manual and see what chemistries are going to be most affected by it. Okay, because not every chemistry will be affected by this. It depends on the reaction that's going on. You may be able to get away with some. So, and somewhere, I think I clicked past my hemolysis side. No, maybe I didn't go through the hemolysis side. Okay, all right. Moving along here. Okay, blood smears. Now, I was taught in school that the very best quality blood smears are going to be made from the tip of the needle, okay, where there isn't even any anticoagulant in it. Again, we were taught to draw the blood. We had two slides in our hand the time we did it. We took it out of the vein, okay. We made two little smears right then and there because they would still be they would not have clotted yet, hopefully, unless you messed around with it. But if you're using the Vacutainer and the Vacutainer hub, you can just pull it out of the vein and press on the butt of the hub, and it will squeeze out about a drop, which is more than enough. I can't stress using the better quality pre-clean slides. I think you'll be in a lot better shape if you do that. Some of the less expensive slides, I find the ones particularly with the tissue paper in between, they leave gunk on the slide, and then you wonder why you can't get a good smear out of those. Yeah. I don't have a particular brand. There's a lot of them that are out there. Make sure it says first quality pre-clean. That's the best I can tell you. Some of them will say that. Some of the not as good slides will say that on them. But you can tell. As far as making the smears, you've got your two techniques, your pusher slide technique, which is the one I learned, and the cover slip technique, which they like to teach in the schools. I cannot do the cover slip technique. I have tried. My hands just don't work that way. The nice thing about the cover slip technique is you get two smears out of it, and you can make a couple of nice slides. So, anyway, this mouse is just going to give me problems. So, anyway, those are your two techniques. Okay, we want your smears to look like this. Some people make longer smears, but you can see we've got a nice feathered edge. That's what we look for. Now, if you're having trouble making slide smears, I found these slides. It's a little hard to see because it's glass, but I found these slides with the cut corner. I call them bevel edge. They call them cut corners. I find that they work a little bit better as a pusher type slide, and they tend also to be better quality slides. So if you get slides that have bevel edges on it, chances are you're going to get one that's going to work pretty well. Okay, DiffQuick stain. You go to a cytology course and they tell you stain it with DiffQuick. Well, DiffQuick is actually a brand name for a three-step stain. Any three-step stain. It's kind of evolved like Kleenex has evolved for tissue. There are many, many three-step Wrights-type stains that are out there. I don't know that one is very much better than another. I happen to like the Hemacolor product, which is actually made by the company who made the original Harlico DiffQuick stain, and they sold that name to another company who since sold it to another company. But DiffQuick has become really a generic term for these three-step stains. The biggest problem I see is not with what stain you use, but with the fact that people don't ever change them. You know, they keep using it and using it and using it and using it, you know, and then they wonder why the smears start to get muddy. So you want to be sure that you kind of replenish those once a week. Now, you do have a problem with the fixative, which is basically methanol with some kind of a non-reactive blue coloring in there. Blue methanol is much more expensive than plain clear methanol. So I always recommend to people, because that is the one that evaporates, I expect out here in Colorado, because of your humidity, it's going to evaporate even faster. You can buy a gallon of plain methanol for about the price of 500 mils of blue fixative. So after you've used up the blue fixative that's in your kit, just buy the plain methanol. It'll save you a lot of money. Okay, WBC estimates. Did you have a question? Yes.
Do you recommend having
I never have recommended it. I've never seen a big problem with it, at least in places where they replenish their stains on a regular basis. You know, it depends, I guess, on kind of, if you do more years and you do cytology, I guess you're going to contaminate them a little bit faster. You know. But I've never run into that problem, because if I'm involved, I just tell them, make sure you change this. And I don't just mean replenish them. That's probably not the right word. Because what they'll interpret that to mean is when it gets down, I'll pour some more in. So I'll just dilute the dirt, you know. Get rid of the stuff completely. You know. So anyway, that would be my answer, nebulous as it is. WBC estimates, and you know, I didn't go through the whole lecture about doing blood smears, but you can even talk to any of these people in the universities or in the reference labs, and they'll be the first ones to tell you. You can buy the most expensive hematology analyzer, and you still need to look at the blood smear. You know, it's just the nature of the game. But one of the things that we can do as we look at the blood smear is to do a little cross-check on some of those counts. And one of those would be an estimate just from looking at the smear. And you should be kind of doing, there's a lot of other things that you want to be doing besides sitting there counting cells. You want to pay attention to morphology. You want to estimate platelets, which I'll show you a little later on, or I guess I'll show you right now. Okay. You want to do a platelet estimate. If you happen to be working with a hematology product, an analyzer, or you might even be able to do it manually, you're not going to get platelet counts. You can do a platelet estimate to determine if you've got adequate numbers. So anyway, I would recommend that you learn to do this particular procedure. Okay, thrombocytopenia. It's just another picture here to show you platelets. And that is platelet aggregation. First of all, on the left-hand side, we do have a thrombocytopenia as a comparison to the last slide that I showed you. And then on the other side, we have what we call those nasty platelet aggregates, which I talked to you about, that occur as a result of poor handling of your samples. Sometimes it's just the nature of the beast, usually in cats. But where this can mess you up is if all the platelets are concentrated in one area, okay, and your analyzer is not seeing these big clumps of platelets, you get a number from some of them and you say, man, this animal is really low on its platelets, where it really isn't. So if you're seeing these aggregates, and this is another good reason to look at a slide, you know, you look at the results coming off your analyzer, you say these platelets look a little funky. You go and you look at the slide and start looking around the edges and you see collections of platelets like this. Okay, now you know where all the platelets went. So the animal probably does have a normal platelet count. So anyway, you want to keep that in mind. One of the things you want to look for on your blood smears. Okay, reticulocyte counts. Allegedly, some of the new instruments out there. Five? Okay. All right. That's fine. We'll go as far as we can. We're going to do another hour, and I'll speed it up. Reticulocyte counts. Some of the new analyzers allegedly do reticulocyte counts. I think some of the counts come out better than others. I think if you really want to do this, you need to probably do it yourself by manual means. When you do a smear, when you're going to do it, you'll be looking at your red cells. And again, you're always going to want to look in the monolayer. But your reticulocytes are going to look like that. Now, this is going to be with your DiffQuick/Wright Stain/Hemacolor/DiffQuick/FastQuick/whatever you want to call it. But you'll see that they'll be more rounded and they'll be slightly darker blue. So you will know that you're dealing with some reticulocytes before you even get to the count. Okay. Here's your procedure. You probably did this in school. Basically, you're going to mix your whole blood with some new methylene blue or brilliant crystal blue. Brilliant crystal blue is hardly around anymore, but some people like the color better. Incubate it, and you're going to make your smear, and you're going to start counting your red blood cells. Now, count your reticulocyte red blood cells. Okay, now there is an eyepiece grid that you can buy, which it's basically a grid, and it's real helpful when you're counting 1,000 cells. But that's what you want to do, or 1,000 reticulocytes, that's what you want to do. And then you're going to convert that count to a percentage. Okay, now the reticulocyte count stained with methylene blue, or new methylene, use new methylene blue, by the way. Methylene blue is a dye, doesn't work as well. But you can see very nicely the reticulum in these cells, and this is what you're going to be counting. Okay, now there are also reticulocytes. These are called aggregate, where you see the reticulum. Sometimes you'll see just a little dot in there. Those are what we call punctate cells. Now, when you're doing your, there's your better picture of your reticulocyte, and then in the smaller picture there in the lower right, you've got your punctate cell. Okay, but remember that in cats, okay, only count the aggregate. Don't count the punctates in cats. All right. In dogs in particular, you want to use a formula to correct for the influence of anemia before you do your absolute count. I think that's in the notes. Okay, but if not, I'll give you a second to write it down. Okay, you know what? Let's take our break now. I want to fix this because this is making me crazy. So take your 5-minute break, if you will. Okay, and let me figure out what's going on here that's keeping me from doing a good job.